This subject, has the internet enhanced or inhibited the workers' understanding of the world? It's something that arose out of a discussion we had elsewhere, and we could just as easily call it, is the internet a help or a hindrance to us? The internet, which only a few decades ago wasn't used by many people, it was probably even unknown by most, it's now omnipresent in 2024. It's been suggested by some people that such a network would be a great help in producing an informed working class who would have an enhanced understanding of capitalism. And armed with this better understanding, the workers would show more solidarity with one another as a class and show at least nascent indications that they were turning revolutionary. But on the other hand, others have said, well, the internet's led to a more fragmented and superstitious class, prone to become victims of numerous online manipulators. You must have heard people on television or radio saying that she or he has done her or his own research. And you think, aha, what's this all about? And quite often, of course, it does turn out to be that the so-called research is bunkum, being used to support some conspiracy story or another. So the internet, just like any other resource really, can be used or abused, or even properly used but wrong conclusions drawn. Two people could go into a public library when or where they still exist or when they still existed, and they could borrow a copy of Mein Kampf, and one who's accustomed to reasonably critical thinking will recognise this book for what it is. But the other may well say, you know, this Hitler chap makes a lot of sense. This is also known as the Hitler was right school of thought. The word thought here being in very, very bold inverted commas. These same two people can, with greater ease, go onto the internet and try to discover what's going on in the world. The critical thinker or the sceptic may well become much better informed and develop a reasonable understanding of the world. So to that extent, that will be quite helpful to both that person and other people in society, especially ourselves, who have a direct interest in seeing people develop a better understanding of the world in which they live. The other person not understanding what constitutes evidence may just reinforce and increase the number of false beliefs held. And in fact, the algorithms on the internet will often just give you more and more of the same, whether that be factual information or utter drivel and prejudice. Years ago, when in Glasgow branch we used to have outdoor meetings, and then after those outdoor meetings we would go to the pub basically for the rest of the evening. So sometimes on a Saturday night, you could meet with a certain amount of risk, certain amount of danger in the city, through no fault of your own. And sometimes this necessitated a visit to casualty. Fortunately, nobody was seriously hurt, and sometimes you could delay going to casualty because it wasn't a serious injury, but you knew you would never see a GP in sufficient time, so you would just pop into casualty after the weekend was over and things were a lot less busy. But the point of the casualty story is that NHS forums in those days, it's decades ago now, asked for one's religion, and having none was not an option on the forum then. Trying to get this on the forum was almost impossible. So many years later, in fact just a few years ago at work, before a bunch of people who were slightly older than me just retired, I recounted this story at work and explained how, in exasperation, I had responded to the NHS inquirers. I had said, when they said, "What religion?" I said, "Oh, Zoroastrian then." And this was met with incredulity by my audience, who had never heard of Zoroastrianism. And someone said, "Google it." And they proceeded to do that, with me, of course, smugly looking on. And then somebody, once they found it, said, "He's right." And, of course, I said, "Well, of course I'm right." And I just found their trust in Google was quite interesting. They treated it like a modern-day oracle. So they arrived at the right answer, but by just trusting the machine, or as George Bush, quite properly for once, called it the Google machine, because while it was operating under that program, you could properly call it a Google machine. So anyway, that was an example of how people had grown in a relatively short space of time to have trust in Google. Now, some would argue now that Google has deteriorated this to quite an extent, and it's much more geared to giving you an answer that will perhaps somewhere along the line extract some money from you. But that's just another danger on the internet, and a danger in society in general. All types of technology have been considered dangerous in their time. During the Reformation in Europe, both sides weaponized printing. But the church authorities who wanted to maintain their control over what people read and consequently what they might think didn't want people reading the Bible for themselves and, God forbid, interpreting the damn thing. That would lead to schism and atheism. And, well, they were actually right about that because, you know, that's what eventually happened, albeit via numerous and tortuous subdivisions of Protestantism and the later Enlightenment and other developments in scientific understanding of the world. So all technology in its time has been considered dangerous by the authorities who don't like change, and considered beneficial by those who do seek change. And on a subject that's been in the news recently is the so-called AI, about which we've had a discussion in the past. A guy was being interviewed or asked on television about, was he not worried about being funded by, in this case it was the United States Navy, who had funded his experiments into artificial intelligence at the time. And he said, "No, I'm not worried by that," because he said all types of technology has been abused throughout history, and this is just another example of technology which will probably, like everything else, end up being abused by someone. So he found that as a useful way to justify why he was quite willing to work in that field, knowing that his employers would no doubt abuse the technology that he was helping to develop in due course. For a long time, people have argued, and are still arguing, over broadcast media like radio, cinema, and later television. There was a woman called Mary Whitehouse many years ago who, despite being a wage slave herself, identified very closely with ruling class interests, and she promoted numerous moral panics about how television was encouraging what they called then the permissive society. You don't hear that expression used very much nowadays, except by really old fogies that are really out of touch with the current world. But the permissive society was this relaxation, I suppose, that took place from the 1960s onwards, relaxation of the old style morality that was very tight-headed and very strongly Christian in this country. And gradually that's, of course, died out. But she objected to a film which probably most of us know, called The Life of Brian, which was a very amusing but innocuous little film. But she claimed it blasphemed against the alleged saviour of the world, this being Jesus Christ, according to her and many other people. But the film actually was something that made more fun of the proliferation of mad left-wing groups and their esoterica during the 1970s. Brian was not the Messiah, and as his mum said, he's not the Messiah, he's a very naughty boy. Or as any Jewish people around Palestine might have said, not the Messiah or the Mashiach, as they say, but just another Meshuggah. And there was no shortage of them roaming about the area. So this is what this film was really about, was basically how ideas can get distorted through transmission, and also taking a real, quite a heavy dig at the left-wing groups that usually had some name of popular front within it, some description as being part of a popular front, but some would be the people's popular front, but some would be the popular front of the people. So they all had similar words, titles with the same words in them, but arranged differently. And, you know, trying to figure out what the differences were was, you know, well, it was quite pointless because the differences didn't really amount to a hill of beans, as Humphrey Bogart might say. So we now come to the actual internet, and it's a network of, I suppose, information and misinformation, but it didn't start out that way. There's plenty of websites where useful information can be obtained. You can go on to NASA, and as soon as you go on there, it'll tell you site at the moment that's, or the story that's there at the moment is 90 years of our changing views of Earth. So that's quite interesting. But they also have an Origins of Life section, and they quite deliberately call it the Origins of Life now, because they're looking at, you know, potential origins in different parts of the universe. So life may have occurred more than once. We know that it did occur once for sure, but you know, fragments of what you might call the building blocks of life are found in meteorites and so on, that have been traveling through space. So, you know, it's quite feasible that it may have origins in different parts of the universe. So that's some useful information you can get. There's the Office of National Statistics website, which is quite useful. It gives some information on internet usage, for example. But although some of that could be qualitative, it's difficult to make a judgment from it. The studies haven't been of sufficient depth, I don't think, yet to draw particular conclusions. But you can definitely see that more and more people are using the internet because they've asked a series of questions that help them to identify, you know, the extent to which people are using the internet. And people in the upper age groups are people over 70 and so forth, unlike what was previously thought, are actually using the internet more, which shouldn't become as a surprise because the population is getting older. So these same people a decade ago who were using some facility, the websites and so on, all that's happened is they've grown older in the meantime, so they can still do what they could do then. There's no difficulty with people being older and suddenly forgetting everything they once knew. So of course, there's the World Socialism website, which we all know you can download the standard from. So that's a wealth of useful information. And there's the BBC's website. And another one that's maybe quite surprising, is it surprised me a few years ago, was the Parliament website. You can get some interesting historical articles on subjects there as well, stuff to do with, you know, Parliament itself and episodes in British history. So this is, in fact, these useful sort of stores of information, that was the original purpose really behind what later was to become the internet. But unfortunately, there's no shortage of scams, conspiracy stories, and fake news on the internet too. And by fake news, of course, I don't mean it in the Trumpian sense. When I first heard the expression fake news, I thought, well, what's new? That's what we've been fed our whole lives. That's what the capitalist class teach us, tell us to trust in them and their governments, and everything will be just fine. And we'll just turn challenges into opportunities and everything will be just great. Capitalism's such a wonderful society. So that's something about the internet. It has both good and bad aspects to it. Unfortunately, in recent times, there's been a resurgence of flat earthers, actual flat earthers, would you believe it, in recent days, it's in the last few years. And there is one in particular called David Weiss, and there's a link which I can probably send you in the chat, and it shows you him being, it's titled Professor Dave Humiliates Flat Earther David Weiss. And I can't remember if this is the same one I saw before, where I thought the scientists got rather unduly upset with the flat earther, who was clearly taking the piss. But taking the piss in the sense that he was probably pretending to believe it, and that he can make money from his websites where people come on and actually believe this rubbish. Because I've seen comments by some of his audience who say, yes, David Weiss opened my eyes. And I thought, my God, where have you been? What were you doing most of your life that this imbecile opened your eyes? But anyway, he seems to be the main flat earther at the moment that a lot of people think is wonderful. So that tells you something about the quality of the audience if they think this guy is wonderful. And of course, there's a large amount of overlap between these people and those who deny that the moon landings, for example, ever took place. And these people, in turn, look at Buzz Aldrin's anger, who, I mean, he's ended up, he's punched some people because they become so irksome to him, because they used to just appear, he would be there for some proper lecture on the subject of moon landings and serious discussion about it, and these people would come along denying that the moon landings had taken place. So he quite rightly got quite annoyed by it, but he got to the extent where he actually punched some people. But these people take his anger with the people that deny the moon landings ever happening, and Neil Armstrong's reluctance to talk about them. Both of these things are used as evidence by some of these people of the conspiracy, as they would say, to mislead us about the lunar expeditions. And why would they do that? And whose interest would that be? It's just all very strange. We can't pretend to understand why some of these people believe these things. We can get an inkling of it to some extent, but there's no point in pontificating about it and trying to say, well, this is just all an example of this, that, or the other, and this, that, and something else will solve it all. But young earth creationism, for example, that's another silly notion which is pushed by religious fundamentalists on the internet. And of course, there's all the other conspiracy narratives that have been around for decades. I mean, there's one I can remember from when it actually happened, and the way it affected us, my brother and I at the time, was that we almost missed an episode of Doctor Who because of the Kennedy assassination. But they did repeat it later, so everything was okay. But anyway, John F. Kennedy and his brother Robert F. Kennedy, they were assassinated. And many people have agonised over, you know, all the possibilities of, you know, all sorts of conspiracies that might have been involved. And I'm in no doubt there was a conspiracy to kill both of these people. But as I've said to many people in the past, don't worry about it. Just be grateful they're dead. These are just people that supported the capitalist system very rich people that had a good life while they did live. And don't worry about it. We don't need to get to the bottom of every single conspiracy. But it's not as convoluted as people think. They made enemies throughout their lives, and then they welched on some arrangements they had with some rather nasty people. So it's anyone's guess who killed them. And anyway, who really cares in the scheme of things? Doesn't matter that much. There's also the death of Diana Spencer, the Princess of Wales, who, funnily enough, when the news of that was announced, she wasn't actually dead, or they didn't know that she was dead at the time. And I heard it on the World Service in the early hours of a Sunday morning. And my first thought was, a bit like the conspiracy people, I thought, my God, they've botched it. And, you know, because it did seem feasible that the then Prince of Wales might have said something like, can't someone rid me of this troublesome princess? But I think in actual fact, of course, the withdrawal of royal protection, together with her carelessness and perhaps even recklessness, and together with that of her friends, was probably enough to put them in the danger they encountered. And unfortunately for them, they didn't survive it. So that's another thing that there's conspiracy stories about, that I think I've heard it said that it was Prince Philip that arranged it, but others have said, well, maybe it was Charles himself. Who knows? But I don't think in this case there was a conspiracy. The withdrawal of royal protection was probably enough. There's other women, we could go through a whole list of stories. These are just some of them. There's the alleged substitution of another celebrity's child for one of Harry and Meghan Markle's children, because it's been alleged that the first child, I only discovered this a few days ago, it's been alleged that the first child of this couple doesn't exist, and they had to borrow a child from somewhere else. And I didn't bother to read any detail about it because it's quite ridiculous. And again, who cares anyway? It's a bit like the stories you get in newspapers about what the royal family does at Christmas time. And if you read different newspapers, they'll have different activities that they do. And, you know, this stuff is really quite quite silly. I've got a picture here in front of me, which I can't really show you, but it's basically a stereotypical alien. And this is just to remind me of, there was a story in recent months where they claimed to have found in, I think, an airport somewhere in Peru, and they had found these aliens. And the cameras moved in and showed you these alleged aliens. And it struck me as really quite amusing that it was the stereotypical alien that Hollywood invented all these years ago. And it was funny how people from another part of the universe that were alleged to exist knew when they came to Earth to look a certain way so that we would know that they were in fact aliens. So I found that quite amusing. But a guy that was trying to report this in all seriousness just made a total and utter fool of himself telling this story. But a lot of people are quite gullible and believe these things. There's more general conspiracy stories or fake histories, like there's the so-called swoon story that Jesus Christ didn't die on the cross, and there's several variants of that, one of which is that he persuaded the guy that they tell a story approvingly that somebody helped carry the cross for him, and instead of him being grateful and still going to his death, meekly, as the story claimed, what he did was he conned the Roman authorities into thinking that he was that that person who helped carry the cross, and that other person was him. He made that person, this is one of his last, well, maybe his last miracle, made him look like himself, and made himself look like this good Samaritan that tried to help him. Which is definitely a dirty, rotten trick for anyone to play, never mind somebody who claims to be the saviour of the world. So That's another quite amusing one in one of its variants. One of the other variants is, of course, the one the Muslims have, that they only appeared to die. I'm not quite sure how what the details of that are. But again, these things don't really matter that much. Did this person even exist? Well, there's so many stories about them that we generally accept that when there's stories about someone in history, okay, we'll accept that they did exist. But were the things that they claimed to be true? Well, no, of course not. You know, there are no gods, so we know he's not either the son of this god or as the Bible writers became more emboldened, they decided, do you know what? He's not just the son of God, he's actually God himself. So, you know, these conspiracy stories, fake histories, they're not new to the internet. They've been around for a long time, and the internet just helps to, spread them more easily and create more variants of them. There's stories about the descendants of Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene, and then the machinations of the Knights Templar, the Illuminati, Freemasons and such like. And then in more modern times, when I say more modern times, to some of the younger people, it won't be that modern, but in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a guy called Erich von Daniken, we used to call him, but I noticed a couple of days ago that he has an umlaut above the A in German, so that would make it von Daniken or Daniken. But he wrote books, well, a massive amount of books. Can't be absolutely sure on this, but I got the impression back then that he started out as a serious inquirer and then realised he could make more money from selling books that just came to ridiculous conclusions. And there was one called Chariots of the Gods, I think that was his first book, and a whole lot of books with titles like God Was an Astronaut and stuff like that, and, you know, God came from different parts of the universe, various different, some of which were questions, others of which were saying origin of the gods, that's another one. But anyway, all that stuff basically suggested that it must have been aliens, and of course primitive people at the time would have seen these aliens as gods, because any technology that's not explicable to people of the time would seem like magic to them or godlike. But all that stuff was rebutted by an Australian archaeologist called Peter White, who wrote a book called The Past is Human. And he explained quite easily how people could gather stones, move massive rocks and whatnot to build things like Stonehenge, to build pyramids, to build the statues in Easter Island, and so on and so forth. So he explained how it was all quite feasible with contemporary technology of the time. It wasn't difficult. Von Daniken was just cashing in on people's gullibility and, you know, keenness to read an interesting slant on things, that, oh yeah, these people came from other planets and they did things, but it kind of detracts from human capability. So it was good that Peter White wrote this book, The Past is Human, which is a good title to explain that human beings were, of course, capable of doing these things, primitive though they might well have been at the time. There was, in very recent times, a story written by an AI program, artificial intelligence program, about the physicist Sean Carroll, which seemed quite a good story, but was mostly just made up, because he himself does some podcasts. And when I saw, I think it was back in November, but I couldn't find it when I was looking for it again recently. But he said the story that the AI had concocted about him was just made up. It said that he had met his wife when they were both at university. I can't remember if it said she was studying physics as well, but the story had certain things I recognised about it. In his life, it didn't happen that way. But in Albert Einstein's life, who coincidentally was another physicist, He did meet his first wife when they were both studying physics at university. So taking facts about some physicist somewhere and added them on to another physicist somewhere else and somewhen else, and produced an interesting but totally made up story. So this is another example of some of the things that can happen on the internet. There's also, in terms of some of the nonsense that people try to persuade you to believe, there's what in America they call they call them gish gallopers. And the gish gallopers are people who they confront anyone they're having a discussion with a whole series of rapid and specious arguments and half-truths and misrepresentations and outright lies. And that makes it almost impossible for the opponent to refute them all. And that in turn gives the impression to the ignorant listener that, you didn't answer this point or at that point, but you couldn't possibly answer these points. So what you would probably have to do with a person that's so dishonest in discussion is seize on the silliest of their arguments and just stick with it and just reduce it to complete and utter smithereens in the hope that people would see that someone had argued something that was really quite silly. But this is a term that was, this, the gish galloper thing, I had heard about it for a few years, but I didn't know where it came from until very recently. And I discovered there's an anthropologist, she's called Eugenie Scott from America, and she had some discussions with the creation scientists. They like to call themselves creation scientists, or there's another, intelligent design science they call it as well. But it's nothing to do with science. It's just another way to try and push fundamentalist religion. But she named it after an American creationist called Duane Gish, who argued in that fashion and used that technique frequently when trying to challenge scientific facts, particularly to do with evolution. So there's other dangerous people. There's a long-winded guy who I can't remember, a long-winded Canadian psychobabbler that defends reactionary ideas. He does seem to have what they would call bona fides in terms of capitalism on account of being an actual psychobabbler, but his main purpose seems to be to defend reactionary ideas, but tries to do it in a very circumlocutory and very sort of, it's not so much a gish galloper as gish galloper, as someone who speaks in sentences that are so convoluted and long-winded that they just disembark nowhere and you're just left unsure of what was he talking about, what was he trying to say. And then there's all of this and its interaction with so-called social media. And although social media itself I haven't said much about, partly because I don't really use it myself, but I know of people who do, and some of them find it quite useful for real worthwhile things that they do, but others find that they end up having stupid, pointless arguments with people on it. So again, that tends to be on the negative side of what happens on the internet. So I'm sure there's lots of other things people could mention, and I've probably mentioned enough as it is. So I'll leave things there at the moment and invite the rest of you to contribute whatever you would like to say on the subject. Thanks very much.